Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, our weekly radio magazine of the performing arts here on KALW. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week I'll be talking with Greg Eldridge, the apprentice stage director at the 2019 Merula Opera Program, which concludes its summer festival with the grand finale this Saturday evening with full orchestra conducted by George Manahan. From the San Francisco Choral Society, I'll talk with conductor and artistic director Bob Geary about the ensemble's upcoming concerts, featuring a semi-staged version of Carmina Burana, as well as the world premiere of Teach Your Children, a new work by composer David Lang, who will also join in the conversation. Lead actors Evan Alexander Smith and Allinger Grovey of the touring production of The Play That Goes Wrong, which is at the SHN Golden Gate Theater for 1 week only, will be in studio to talk about that production. Stay with us. San Francisco's acclaimed Merula Opera Program wraps up its summer festival Saturday evening with the Merula Grand Finale, a concert at the War Memorial Opera House featuring the 29 young international artists selected from over 800 applicants in the 2019 Merula Opera Program. They'll showcase a dazzling array of opera's most exciting arias and ensembles. The production will be conducted by Maestro George Manahan, music director of the American Composers Orchestra and Portland Opera, and he directed directed by the 2019 Merula Apprentice Stage Director Greg Eldridge, who joins me in studio. Greg has worked on more than 40 productions in 7 countries and is on the board of Stage Directors UK. He's coached at studios all over the world, including the Victorian College of the Arts in Australia, the Lyric Opera of Weimar in Germany, the Music Academy International in Italy, and the Birmingham Conservatoire in the UK, among others. Greg, welcome to Open Air.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, this grand finale represents a little bit of a different opportunity for you. Rather than a single production, you get to work on many productions in one evening.
Yeah, indeed. And what an enormous range of repertoire it is. There's something quite exciting for a director to come in. As you say, we're used to having sort of a year lead time to prepare one production and to get to know that in really intimate detail and then work for 3 or 4 weeks with a series of singers. And in a concert like this, we have 6 languages, we have 7 different musical periods, we've got interior, exterior, after the battle, before the battle, everything from sort of 1950s music all the way back to Mozart. So it's an enormously eclectic range of things to work on, which is quite exciting for us because it certainly keeps it fresh when you're trying to think about how to stage a bel canto piece, which is immediately preceded by, you know, something from the 18th century.
Mm. Are you given any sort of, obviously we can't have grand sets and, you know, what you would see in a full production of some of these works, but what sort of restrictions are you under and what kind of leeway are you offered?
Yeah, well, it's an exciting thing. The Merula program sort of is allied with the San Francisco Opera, and so they gift us a set that they're working on, and this year we'll be working on their Billy Budd set.
Oh, fantastic.
Which is, in fact, a production that premiered in Glyndebourne, which is a theatre that I've worked in and that I have a great deal of love for, and so it felt very much like sort of walking back into the rooms in Sussex. Uh-huh. which was a joy for me. It's a fabulous set that we're on. It's obviously it's a giant man-of-war ship. Very wooden, really beautiful to sing in, lots of levels for us to work on. So although it's quite specific in its nature as a set piece for the production of Billy Budd, it provides us with a lot of opportunities to be able to transfer focus and transfer period quite easily in a fairly neutral but very singer-friendly environment, which does help.
Mm-hmm. Any of these particular scenes completely new to you, or some of these more familiar?
When we were discussing the program, I was really pleased to see that there are a number of them that are not only well known to me but are absolute favorites of mine, mm-hmm. Which is hugely important, because it means not only do I know the work already, but I have so many ideas for how to work with the singers in order to bring out the character and bring out the sense of occasion for each of them.
And then in some cases, it's the first time for these singers involved in this in this particular scene or production. So it's you bringing a great deal of knowledge to that.
Yeah, it's a fun thing. One of my favorite things, I do a lot of assisting work, as you so kindly mentioned in your introduction. And one of the joys of that is that I get to work with really well-established, renowned directors who have really keen and clear insights into pieces, and it helps me work out as I'm working with them what I would do in the same situation in my own production. And now here I get a chance to try some of that out.
Well, you've been, as I mentioned in the introduction, directing all over the world. What's it like now being an assistant, an apprentice stage director in the Merylo program, and what are you learning?
Yeah, it's the United States has been somewhere I've always wanted to visit. It's one of those places that I've never had the opportunity yet to come to. One of the reasons I moved from my native Australia to the UK, where I've been based for about the last decade, was because I thought it was a beautiful midway point between the American school of drama and theatre and the European schools of drama and theatre.
Well, tell us what those differences are in your mind.
Yeah, well, coming from Australia, where our view of theatre is, as a new world country, perhaps slightly less steeped in tradition and more a reaction to current social goings-on, the European systems seem to have so much history and so many centuries of political involvement and of large-scale social statement that they carry with them the weight of those years. And so it felt very much when I first moved to the UK that I was moving into a brand new market of people who had really strong connotations with certain things, certain periods of music or certain dramatic styles. And the US had always seemed to me to be similar to Australia in being keen to explore nuance and social relevance in pieces rather than just relying on the weight of their history. So certainly one of the reasons I wanted to come out to the USA was a number of the American singers that I'd met in Europe or at Covent Garden, which has sort of been my home theatre for the past 5 or 6 years. Each of those American artists had something special about them. They were very keenly focused on character. They were very clearly based in ensemble work and happy to share the focus without us needing to go through and prescribe it for them. And I thought, you know, I would love to have the opportunity to go and see how American singers train, because so many of them are so very, very good. And really, for directors, there are only two programs in the world. There's Covent Garden, which has a young artist program for directors. They take one director every 2 years. And the Merylo program here, which takes one director out of a cohort of around 30 people every year. And having completed my time at Covent Garden and loved it, I thought, okay, good, I've got a summer free. I've always wanted to go. Why don't I see if they'll let me come along and have some fun in San Francisco, a place I've always wanted to visit but hadn't yet.
So who in the program is acting as your mentor or guiding?
Yeah, so for us, largely the work of directors and assistant directors is quite a lonely one. So we spend a lot of time in paperwork. We spend a lot of time with stage management, liaising between departments, liaising between wigs and costume and production and so on. And really, the experience for us is exactly that of being in a house. It's exactly the same thing as being in the opera house anywhere in the world. You've got the same tiny little office somewhere where you've got to try and make everything fit in a schedule and please 17 different people. And so my work as an assistant here has been with Jose Maria Condemi and Keturah Stikkan, who did the If I Were You production, the new commission written by
Jake Heggie.
Which was fabulous and great fun to work on. And so really my work has been focused there as a proper assistant, alongside coaching singers and, you know, doing all the fun dramatic stuff that we all like to do.
Now, tell me a little bit about your own approach to directing and staging. Are you more a traditionalist when it comes to the operas? Do you like to push the envelope in a contemporary setting of a classic, or what? Or a combination of the?
Yeah, I'm always hesitant with the word traditionalist because I'm not quite sure what it means to everyone. And I have a very specific idea of what it means, and so I'm not ashamed to call myself one. But I don't want to encroach on someone else's definition. My work has always, because I come from a theatre background, my work has always been rooted in the text and in wanting to have believable relationships between people that is then supported by the emotional content of the music. And this works, I think, generally speaking, in most operatic repertoire. Once we start getting sort of postmodern, where the music is acting as a dissonance to the emotional context of the scene, it becomes a bit trickier. But I like to think that the way that I approach works is to allow an exploration of what all the possible meanings could be and then find the best ones, working with the singers, to create a scene that works for them.
And tell me what is happening in your own directing world after this.
Yeah, well, I've got a lovely break of 3 days in which I'll go back home to the UK and wash my clothes and pack again. Then I'm off to Australia. I'm directing a new production for the National Company in Australia of Arabet Reimann's Gespenstersonate, the Ghost Sonata, which is based on the Strindberg play. And that's... I heard word the other day that it's sold out already. It's Sydney and Melbourne seasons, which is a joyous thing, so it had better be good now. I'll have to think about it on the plane. And after that, I'm back at Covent Garden working with one of my regular directors and mentors, Sir David McVicar. He's doing a new production of Death in Venice at Covent Garden, which I absolutely can't wait for.
Indeed. Off mic before the show, we talked a little bit about, you know, your background, Australian, but now living in the UK, and inevitably the turmoil right now that's surrounding Brexit. And you had an interesting perspective as an artist and how it's going to affect the arts.
Yeah, indeed. Well, for the majority of my colleagues in the UK who have British citizenship and nothing else, it's been a really frightening time for them. There have been credible reports from a number of my colleagues that they're no longer being accepted for auditions in Germany, or contracts are being offered in France with the explicit disclaimer that they won't accept British applicants because no one knows what's going to happen.
Wow.
We just, it's the most amazing time to be in the UK because no one really knows how it's all going to pan out, if it's going to happen at all. There's a friend of mine who's an orchestra manager who had set up a tour 3 or 4 years ago to go through Germany with his string quartet, and they're due to fly on the day that Brexit is supposed to be enacted, and they have no idea what papers they'll need when they arrive at the other end, what will happen when they get into Charles de Gaulle in Paris, whether they'll have to provide additional bits of information. It's a really interesting time to be in the UK. At least I can always go back to Australia. You know, the scene may not be as big, but the beaches are nice.
Wow. Some interesting times ahead, that's for sure.
Indeed.
Talking with Greg Eldridge, who's the 2019 Merula Apprentice Stage Director, staging the Merula Grand Finale, which will have a variety of operas represented, including Mozart's Così fan tutte, La Finta Giardiniera, Barber's Vanessa, Donizetti's Maria Stuarda, and La Fille du Regiment, as well as scenes from Offenbach, Bellini, Dvorak, Poulenc, which that must be a fun one to stage from Dialogues of the Carmen.
Oh my God, absolutely. It's fabulous.
That and many more, including Gounod's Romeo and Juliet, which will be staged by the San Francisco Opera this fall as well. Opening night will be Romeo and Juliet. Halévy, Thomas, and Verdi's Falstaff and La Traviata, among others, including music from Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier, which we'll hear shortly to go out. Greg, I wish you the best in the rest of your stay here in San Francisco and beyond. Come see us again, if you can get to the U.S.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'll do my best. I might have to if Brexit goes ahead.
Thanks for coming in.
No worries. Thank you.
Incredible music of Richard Strauss from Der Rosenkavalier, which you can hear as part of the Merula Grand Finale this coming Saturday evening at the War Memorial Opera House, 7:30 p.m. The stars of tomorrow will be showcased in a number of fantastic scenes from a variety of operas. Go to merula.org for more information. Their box office number is 864-3330, by the way, 415-864-3330. Still to come, we'll be talking with lead actors from The Play That Goes Wrong at the Golden Gate Theater here for only a week. And next, it's a pleasure to welcome back Bob Geary and composer David Lang for the first time to open air. The San Francisco Choral Society will continue its 30th anniversary season with a semi-staged version of Karl Orff's Carmina Burana and the world premiere of Teach Your Children by David Lang, a new choral work commissioned by the organization in celebration of its milestone year. Led by Artistic Director Robert Geary for some 25 years, this particular program will be presented twice at Davies Symphony Hall this Friday and Saturday at 8 p.m. and features a selection of artists and ensembles, including soprano Marnie Breckenridge, tenor J. Raymond Myers, and bass baritone Eugene Brancoviano, the California Chamber Symphony, and the Piedmont East Bay Children's Choir. Bob Geary, a founding director of the Piedmont East Bay Children's Choir, Volte, and the Golden Gate International Choral Festival, also serves as the artistic director of the San Francisco Choral Society, as I mentioned, for some 25 years. Under his direction since its founding in 1979, Volte has become recognized as one of the leading new music ensembles in the country. And for over 30 years, he has overseen the development of the Piedmont East Bay Children's Choir. With his guiding vision, the Golden Gate International Children's and Youth Choral Festival has become part of the international choral environment, bringing thousands of young singers from dozens of countries to California for performances and competition. I've also had the pleasure of collaborating with Bob as narrator for a couple of works and hope to do that more. Always a pleasure to welcome Surfer Boy Bob Geary, young at heart, all over the...
Thank you, King David.
Oh, yeah, indeed. That was quite an experience, that's for sure. Also pleased to be joined by composer David Lang, who I should start with a quote. With his winning of the Pulitzer Prize for The Little Match Girl Passion, one of the most original and moving scores of recent years, David Lang, once a post-minimalist enfant terrible, has solidified his standing as an American master. So says The New Yorker, and I second that emotion. David, welcome.
Hi.
David is one of America's most performed composers. Many of his works resemble each other only in the fierce intelligence and clarity of vision that inform their structures. His catalog of works is extensive, and his opera, orchestra, chamber, and solo works are by turns ominous, ethereal, urgent, also described as hypnotic, unsettling, and very emotionally direct. They have such intriguing titles as Symphony for Broken Instruments, Loud Love Songs, Harmony and Understanding for Orchestra and Audience, and Eating Living Monkeys, which we may or may not talk about later. His opera Prisoner of the State, for which he also wrote the libretto, was just premiered this past June in New York by the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Jaap van Zweden. It's the story of a woman who disguises herself as a prison guard to rescue her husband from unjust political imprisonment. His opera, The Loser, opened the 2016 Next Wave Festival at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and for which David also served not only as composer and librettist, but as stage director. The Public Domain for 1,000 singers at Lincoln Center's Mostly Mozart Festival is also in his repertoire. In addition to the Pulitzer, also on a shelf somewhere nearby in his home is an Academy Award, Golden Globe nominations, Music of America's Composer of the Year Award, Carnegie Hall's Debs Composer's Chair, the Rome Prize, and many other honors. He's also one of the co-founders of the now mainstay of the new music world, the Bang on a Can Festival. David, welcome to Open Air.
Hi there.
Bob, so you must have been familiar with David's works. I know you've recorded some with one of your groups.
Well, I think the main exposure was in 2011, maybe, with the premiere of David's Battle Hymns, which I heard in Philadelphia at the Chorus America National Conference, and I just came out of it kind of looked at my art executive director, Barbara Hureau, who was with me, and just said, "What just happened?" You know, it was one of those things that was just stunning and provocative and and a lot of reflection was needed to understand it. And for me, that's a really high artistic experience. I mean, I love that when that happens. I love when things are not presented to me directly and with questions and answers, but, you know, more an opportunity to delve into musical ideas and philosophical ideas in a personal way. Mm-hmm. So David's music unlocked that for me, and that has led to this commission, Teach Your Children. I've also done a couple of his other pieces with Volti, shorter works. But Teach Your Children, I think, also has some similarities in the way it invites the performers and the audience to become participants in it, just in the way he's set text and then the musical environment he's created. So it's unique.
And this represents a 12th commission for San Francisco choral artists.
Yeah, Choral Society. Yeah, we're very proud of that. And David's won so many awards, his ears aren't going to burn. But, you know, it's the first time we've actually said, let's try to see if we can have an A-list composer. We've worked with a lot of younger composers and local composers, but we wanted to work with somebody who was an established American force. Mm-hmm. So we're very pleased that David was willing to work with us.
So, David, let's talk about Teach Your Children and its genesis, how it was formed and how it's being presented.
Well, so when Bob asked me to do this, you know, one of the exciting things and one of the challenges was how to make something that would really belong to this community. So as you mentioned, I did this piece for the New York Philharmonic just this year. I work with musicians of all different levels. I'm used to writing music, which is really hard, that really great musicians have to work really hard to play. This is a completely different thing. This is a group of people who love music, who come together and they sing together so they can build this kind of utopian world about how great it is to make something beautiful. Mm-hmm. For me, it requires a kind of change of gears in order to make it so that everyone in this choir and everyone in this community can feel valued, can feel that that they can contribute something. So when Bob asked me to do this, I was trying to think of something that would be appropriate for this community, and I started thinking about kind of larger social issues, as I often do. And one of the things about it is how we, as members of kind of a larger community, I have overseen a bunch of terrible things going on in our world right now. And I think there's a sense for us sometimes, oh, well, you know, the next generation will save us or solve these problems. You know, we're a mess. We've made this mess. Oh, but our children will somehow get us out of this mess. And so I just started thinking, well, if we really believe that, how are we preparing them for this mess? You know, what are we teaching them? So how are we as a community kind of preparing the next generation to solve the problems that we couldn't solve? Mm-hmm. So I went to the internet and I just typed in my search engine the sentence, we must all teach our children too. And then it just auto-completes. And my hope was that I would get a list of things that everyone agreed were important for our children to learn. And that's sort of how this piece began. I just was thinking, well, you know, many people in this chorus might have children, and they might be engaged the same way I am. I have three children who I'm sure I've messed up horribly. And I'm just sort of...
We happen to have one of those on the phone.
Yeah. you know, so it really sort of came out of my curiosity about how we are, you know, kind of trying to solve the problems in the future that we haven't solved yet.
Mm-hmm. So, Bob, bringing this piece to life, talking about that.
Yeah. It's a particular style of sort of chant singing that David uses. Forgive me if I misappropriate words, but there's this a repetitive harmonic basis, and it's non-melodic, and a lot of singers, well, all of us, I think, as singers start off loving singing because we sing melodies, and then as we get more experience and more training, we discover music as something that may or may not have a melody. And so that's been part of the process for the singers to absorb and understand musical structures that are non-melodic and how the relationship of the words and the music is made. And there are particular challenges in this piece in that way. There are also some, you know, the piece is in three movements. The first and last movements are for the San Francisco Choral Society and Marnie Breckenridge, the soprano soloist, and the children's choir, Piedmont East Bay Children's Choir, and then the second movement is Marnie and the children's choir, all of it with orchestra. And so there are sort of sweeping, long-term, I would call it emotional bases for the three movements, each slightly different from the other. So trying to get a concept of all three of those and create continuity in the work. I mean, it's like this with any new work that is of any sophistication at all. I mean, you're just trying to understand what is it the composer is really doing. And David was able to come to our rehearsal Tuesday night, which was our last choral rehearsal. We were very eager for that, to just get a little bit of information. You know, performance practice is always the trick, right? And we're always guessing how they did it 200-300 years ago. But when we can work with a composer, we can actually try to approximate what they were imagining, and so we're getting there. And we've had two rehearsals with David there, and we'll have one more tonight. Mm-hmm. And I think the singers have owned it and really worked hard and are enjoying the process. And I say that because they showed true affection and appreciation in their applause for you, David, at rehearsal. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that premieres this coming Friday and Saturday. At 8 p.m., Davies Symphony Hall. David, earlier we talked a little bit about the battle hymns of yours that Bob also recorded with the Piedmont East Bay Children's Choir, of which he's been director. Can you tell us a little bit about the genesis of those songs, so we can hear a little bit of your music? We're going to hear I'll Be a Soldier in particular. But tell us about the genesis of that work, battle hymns.
Battle Hymns was a commission from another community choir, so in Philadelphia, and it was a co-commission with an organization that was about putting art in historical places in Philadelphia, and the historical place we chose to use was an armory. And one of the things that was interesting about that armory was it was a depot for soldiers who were going from the Union to go fight in the Civil War. And so I thought, if you imagined the voices of the families whose sons, whose fathers, whose brothers were about to go to war, that they were all still there, what's the life like for those people who are remaining in that hall? So I didn't want to set something about the battle. I didn't want to set something about good and bad, about the South or the North. It was just the lives of the people who were there watching their people go. And so I found texts that I thought were particularly interesting. Three of the texts I found were Stephen Foster songs. So Stephen Foster songs. Stephen Foster was, of course, a big songwriter during the Civil War, and he wrote a lot of songs about soldiers. He wrote a lot of songs. You know, he was trying to sell his songs, right? And so this was on everybody's mind. Mm. So he wrote patriotic songs. He wrote songs about people leaving, people dying on the battlefield, you know, whatever you could make a melody out of and sell. Mm-hmm. And so I chose three of his songs. One of them, I'll Be a Soldier, is about a little boy who's really excited about how when he grows up he's going to become a soldier. And of course, you know, we all know that that has tragic possibilities in it, but that was oddly missing from his song. So I tried to take some of his text to reshape it so that a little bit of that would still be left in the song.
Let's hear a little bit of I'll Be a Soldier from David Lang's Battle Hymns, then more with David Lang and conductor Bob Geary. text from Stephen Foster, I'll Be a Soldier, one of the movements of Battle Hymns by Pulitzer Prize-winning composer David Lang. That's from a recording done live at the Kezar Pavilion back in 2013. Bob Geary with the Leostein Dance Company, as well as the Piedmont East Bay Children's Choir and the San Francisco Choral Society. Beautiful work indeed, and does make you... It makes you think.
Thanks.
You were talking earlier about social relevance and the kind of world that we're leaving the next generation. Wow, what's going to come out of this administration in terms of artistry? Yeah. Is it going to, instead of Nixon in China, will it be Trump in North Korea or something?
So my piece that I did at the New York Philharmonic was a rewrite of Fidelio. So, and it's something that I wanted to do for a very long time, and I've been working on for a very long time. And it was started way before the Trump administration and has nothing to do with Trump. But of course...
Everything does now.
Everything does. You know, it's, I think that's the real kind of power of the political world that we're in right now, is that you have to sort of see lots of things through that lens. And, you know, that's sort of unfortunate, but hopefully that's also galvanizing, you know.
Bob, after these performances, this is you've been doing these concerts at the Davie Symphony Hall for some time. What's happening next in the Choral Society world?
Yeah. A radical shift. We're moving back to do kind of a Bach extravaganza. So we're going to sing the second half of the Weihnachtsoratorium, the Christmas oratorio,
nice.
And his iconic Magnificat in D.
Oh, two fantastic works.
We start rehearsing in 2 weeks. Could have used an extra week or two.
And those performances will be when?
They'll be right at the beginning of December.
Great. Yeah. More at the Choral Society's website, sfchoral.org. And more on David Lang's music at davidlangmusic.com. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Bob. And the main event, so to speak, at this concert, these concerts at Davies Hall are going to be also a semi-staged version of Carmina Burana.
Yes.
Which is the way, apparently, the composer originally intended the work to be, not just in a choral setting or a concert setting.
Yes, and we don't have a big enough stage to really do it, but our singers will be costumed to some extent. Our soloists will be interactive and staged to some extent, and there will be some dancers there in addition to a large orchestra, a children's choir, and a large choir. So it's a big show.
So you are obviously conducting it. What other aspect of the production? Are you the main artistic forces involved in directing and staging?
No, Mojo Michael Mohammed is doing the staging. And my job is really musical preparation. As a matter of fact, I'm so busy that as they're working out all the staging, I don't even see it. Most of it's behind me. So it's kind of a funny thing. It's like being in the pit, you know, pit orchestra or something. You know, you're not really in the drama.
These performances Saturday, Friday at 8 p.m., Saturday at 8 p.m. at Davies Symphony Hall. We do have some tickets available for you if you'd like to catch either one of those concerts. Five pairs of tickets at Davies Symphony Hall for Carl Orff's Carmina Burana and the world premiere of Teach Your Children by David Lang for listeners that call us now at 415-841-4134. 415-841-4134, the San Francisco Choral Society, along with the soloists Marnie Breckenridge, tenor J. Raymond Myers, wonderful bass baritone Eugene Brancoviano, the California Chamber Symphony, and the Piedmont East Bay Children's Choir. This Friday and Saturday, 8 p.m. 415-841-4134. Looks like the phones have lit up for that. We're going to go out with some music of Carmina Burana. Bob, this is from your recording back in 2012 with some of these same soloists.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Some of the same soloists and an earlier version of the Piedmont East Bay Children's Choir.
Fantastic.
That group is now out of college, I think.
Music from the iconic Carl Orff, Carmina Burana, to end our talk with. David Lang, we look forward to hearing more of your music as it comes out and to explore some of your catalog, too.
Thank you.
Bob, thanks for coming
in. Yeah, thanks for having us, David.
Oh,
From the amazing Carl Orff, Carmina Burana, recording by the San Francisco Choral Society, featuring, you heard the beautiful voice of Marnie Breckenridge, Brian Stoffenbiel on tenor, and Eugene Brancovianu, baritone. They'll be soloists once again with the San Francisco Choral Society's production of the semi-staged version of Carmina Burana, along with the world premiere of David Lang, Teach Your Children, and that's at the Davies Symphony Hall here in San Francisco, Friday and Saturday evening at 8. For ticket information and more information about the program, sfchoral.org, and about David's music, davidlangmusic.com. Well, an appropriate way to start this segment would be, and now for something completely different, as the play that goes wrong, the hilarious Tony Award-winning hit Broadway comedy, opened last night here in San Francisco on its first ever touring production. But don't blink, because it's over before you know it. Closing just for a week, it's going to close this coming Sunday evening. It was co-written by Mischief Theater Company members Henry Lewis, Jonathan Sayer, and Henry Shields. The play that goes wrong is a gut-busting comedy
comedy about the theater. The play introduces us to the fictional Cornley University Drama Society, who are attempting to put on a 20s murder mystery, but as the title suggests, everything then that can go wrong does, as the accident-prone thespians battle on against all odds to get to their final curtain call. The play that goes wrong received a Tony Award for Best Set Design, Broadway.com's Audience Choice Award for Best Play, and the Theater Fans Choice Award for Best Play. It was awarded the 2015 Olivier Award for Best New Comedy and is now in its fourth year in the West End, currently on a 30-week UK tour as well, and playing on six continents. Two of the leads of this production join me here in studio now. Evan Alexander Smith, who plays Chris and the Inspector, and Angela Grovey, who plays Annie, a stagehand that takes a star turn of sorts. Evan was seen on Broadway in Amazing Grace and has been on the national tour of Dirty Dancing. Other company credits include the Toronto Company, Drury Lane Theatre, Cleveland Playhouse, Cincinnati Playhouse, and Shaw Festival. Evan stands out in these roles of the play that goes wrong for a number of reasons. First of all, he's about 8 feet tall with expressive eyebrows, I think, that reach the back seats of the balcony. Welcome to you, Evan.
Thank you. Thank you so much, David.
Angela Grovey, the stagehand that takes a star turn, has Broadway credits that include Escape to Margaritaville, Leap of Faith, as well as the national tour of Newsies, and a bunch of film and TV credits, 30 Rock among them. She's also performed with Irish Rep, City Center Encores, Radio City Music Hall's Christmas Spectacular, the Chicago Shakespeare Company, Paper Mill, Goodspeed Playhouse, among others. If Evan stands out for all the right reasons in this theater, he's well paired with Angela, whose megawatt smile and comedic timing are spot on. Welcome to you, Angela.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Well, Evan, you start things off in this show with an address to the audience as Chris Bean. Can you give us a bit of that to tell folks what they're about to see, or rather what they may have been hoping to see as the creative force behind the Cornley University Drama Society?
Well, absolutely. I play Chris Bean. He's the director, the head of the society. He has sort of taken by force every role within this drama society. We begin the play by welcoming the audience. Many of them are confused to find that they've arrived at the murder at Haversham Manor with their tickets having been stamped as Hamilton tickets.
Which is all the more funny because Hamilton happens to be playing down the street.
So the Cornley University Drama Society, or the Cornley Polytechnic Drama Society, as they call it in the UK, are mounting their most ambitious production to date. They've put on this play called The Murder at Haversham Manor, which is a sort of Agatha Christie-esque 1920s murder mystery, sort of in the vein of The Mousetrap. It is not very good. It is a very boring play with extremely predictable plot twists that I theorize Chris may have written himself under a pen name. And everything goes wrong. It is an actor's nightmare. And for me, it's a particularly painful evening of theater. but I'm surrounded by all of these incredible and incredibly committed comedic actors. You know, Angela, among them, who's one of my favorite people to watch on stage of all time. You know, it's the insanity that's happening all around me for 2 hours is marvelous.
Can you offer us a bit of that opening monologue, perhaps?
Absolutely. Yeah. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Cornley University Drama Society's presentation of The Murder at Haversham Manor.
Yay!
Nicely done.
Thank you.
The comedic timing and the pauses that are in place for this, you must have been just overjoyed by the audience reaction here in San Francisco to this.
Oh, absolutely. We always say the audience is the last cast member of this production. Certainly in San Francisco, we've been bowled over by the audience response. They've been so warm and just down for an incredible time. Some of our most responsive audiences, we're coming to the end of what has been a year-long tour for us.
Wow.
This is our final week. And we're only playing 1 week here in San Francisco. So it's a very special city for us. It's mm-hmm. It's our closing city. And to have such an enthusiastic audience has been just wonderful.
Yeah. Highlights of the tour otherwise than San Francisco, then?
Chicago was pretty amazing. Toronto was also great.
And cities that are new to you folks, or seeing them for the first time
Detroit
in some cases?
Detroit was actually
I'm sure.
a city I'd never visited, and I was blown away by Detroit. I was like, this is a gem in the United States of America, and I didn't even know. Mm-hmm. Loved it.
Absolutely. Sometimes for me, it's some of the smaller cities that I think for a lot of us were quite surprising. You know, playing Greenville, South
yes.
Carolina was, you know, a big highlight for a lot of us. Or Omaha, Nebraska. You know, these cities that you you certainly, I don't think any of us were expecting to be the sort of centerpieces of our experiences. Have been lovely and certainly stand out. In addition to some of those larger, sort of well-known big cities, America is full of incredible communities.
Absolutely.
We've really gotten to experience that this year.
This touring production is directed by Matt DiCarlo, based on the original Broadway direction by Mark Bell. How does Matt keep things fresh and moving in terms of making sure that you offer the space for the audience to react? And
So this rehearsal process and the audition process was unlike sort of any other process I've ever been a part of. So rehearsal, we got in day one, and it was like a day of improv, which if you don't do improv is like your worst nightmare. I think like I had sweaty pits immediately.
I'll have a story for you after.
Oh my God. And so we did these exercises where Maddie, and then we also had one of the original Mischief company members, assistant direct. They played all these exercises with us where they made us sort of feel the ball drop, right? And they would not let us go on until it was appropriate. So we literally were tortured in the beginning part of this rehearsal, because that's exactly what this show needs, is that you feel so uncomfortable that you come up with a solution to keep it going. And that was an exercise, I think, that was super helpful. And when he comes back, he reminds us of that. That this whole play is about the recovery, which is what keeps, I think, this play so interesting, is that remembering that, like, you have to allow the audience to watch you think and recover, which has been a great skill to sort of learn this year for me.
Absolutely.
We mentioned a little bit about Evan's character. Tell us a little bit about Annie.
is a stage manager who's forced into every stage manager's worst nightmare. I won't spoil it for those of you who are racing to go to SHN and get your tickets to see us this week. But I'm forced into, I think, I have to do what any stage manager, any company member would do to make sure that the show goes on. And I will do whatever it takes to make sure that we get to the end of the murder at Haversham Manor, even surprising myself.
So you mentioned the improv training. Do you have some comedic background that you're bringing to either one of you to this, or is this this aspect of hilarity new to you in terms of bringing you to the stage and engaging that, you know, breaking that fourth wall?
I studied musical theater. I went to a theater conservatory in Chicago. I mostly come from a musical theater background, which is, I do a lot of musical comedy, but this is my first play and my first, like, getting my hands into something like this. But I feel like being a part of, like, musical comedy made me a little less fearful about touching this.
Yeah. I studied a little bit of improv in college, but I went to a classical theater conservatory and studied sort of text-based theater in Canada, where I'm from. So improv is not something that is a tool that I easily pull from my belt. You know, I was part of that group on that first day that was sitting in the corner crying. but, you know, in my career, I've been lucky to do both plays and musicals quite a bit, and a lot of British comedy. In Canada, we have a great tradition of that. And at the Shaw Festival, where I worked for a couple of years, it was almost exclusively sort of British theater and British comedy. And so that dialect and that sort of style is something that comes to me pretty quickly. But it's interesting, you know, Angela mentioning coming from musical theater background, a bunch of us have done musicals. And I think that really helps with our understanding of the rhythm of the show, mm-hmm. which is so important to getting the timing right and to understanding how to sort of ride with the audience along the show. I think that's something that musical training has really helped a lot of us with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, the writing and acting style necessary to pull the show off has been called Python-esque. Evan, you must have John Cleese in mind to thank for some inspiration.
Yeah, absolutely. When I first got the audition, you know, I watched Fawlty Towers quite a bit in college, and I remember when I got the call that I was going to go in for this, I went right back. It's all on Netflix, which is amazing. But I went back and watched both of the seasons of it, sort of binged them through in 2 weeks. Uh-huh. And it's funny, you know, all through the auditions too, when we started working with the creators of the show, because they were in America to watch us in our final sets of auditions, it was something they kept bringing up in the auditions too. You know, just think about it's Basil Fawlty. It's Basil Fawlty. It's, you know, it's all of that tension and all of, you know. So that, yeah, that was something that certainly as a sort of centerpiece was important.
Yeah, you've got the physicality down, not to mention the stature.
Thanks.
So you mentioned that this is the last stop for this particular tour. I noticed on the touring website that this goes on, resumes in October in Iowa, then a number of states. Are you involved in those productions at all, or are you guys done with this particular play?
We are passing along the torch, Evan and I specifically, but you might see a couple of familiar faces who are in our company that will join that. But I promise it'll still be the amazing show that you've seen. People have seen us this year.
Sure,
the piece is fantastic.
And nonetheless, a full year of touring is. I think you might want to take a little bit of a break.
I think we all need an ice bath.
I know, some Epsom salts.
Must bring something fresh though every night. With the audience reaction must vary from night to night as well.
It does. I would say that, you know, if you are game to participate, I say get there 15 minutes before the curtain, because there's a pre-show where you might get a little involved in the show. We love being able to reset every night with a different audience. It's really important for this show to reset.
Angela Grovey playing Annie, a stagehand that takes a star turn. Evan Alexander Smith, Chris, and the Inspector in The Play That Goes Wrong. Thank you so much for taking some time with me today.
Thanks for having us,
David.
SHNSF.com for information on that production. Just through this Sunday, tickets are moving fast. It really is a wonderful tonic from the social commentary we're experiencing everywhere. We could all use a belly laugh, don't you think?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I'm David Latulippe. You've been listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW. My producer is Neil Swinkles. Thanks to Niels. Now a birthday week older, our shows are archived at kalw.org. You can catch any of them there. Tell a friend about it. And again, links to all of the productions that you've heard about on today's Open Air is at our website, kalw.org. Thanks for being with us.